One of the major challenges the Obama administration will face is deciding where and how to conduct U.S. policy in the Middle East and Southwest Asia. The U.S. invaded Afghanistan on October 7, 2001, in response to the September 11, 2001 attacks, and has since pursued a war there against the Taliban regime. The U.S. military campaign against Iraq began on March 20, 2003, with the intent of removing Saddam Hussein from power. Pakistan shares a porous 1,500-mile-long border with Afghanistan, from which both al-Qaeda and Taliban militants are thought to operate. The fragility of the Pakistani government complicates this situation, exemplified by the August 2008 collapse of President Pervez Musharraf's regime, an ally of the Bush administration. Iran's alleged nuclear weapons program also demands substantial attention from U.S. policymakers. Israel's 2006 invasion of Lebanon and the recent crisis in Gaza highlight another feature of the complex regional dynamics in this part of the world. We are fortunate tonight to have Michael Scheuer with us this evening to address U.S. policies regarding the Middle East and Southwest Asia. Scheuer worked at the CIA on national security issues related to Islamic extremism for 22 years. From 1996 to 1999, he served as the chief of the Bin Laden unit at the CIA's Counterterrorism Center. He also served as the unit's senior advisor from 2001 to 2004. Scheuer is currently a news analyst for CBS News and a terrorism analyst for the Jamestown Foundation's online publication, Global Terrorism Analysis. He's also the author of the New York Times and Washington Post bestseller, Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terror. His most recent book is Marching Toward Hell, America and Islam After Iraq. A 1974 Canisius College alumnus, Scheuer holds master's degrees from Niagara University and Carleton University, and a PhD from the University of Manitoba. At this time, I'd like to remind you to please turn off all cell phones and pagers. Because this program is being taped, and out of courtesy to those audience members who are hearing impaired, please wait for our microphone to reach you before asking a question. Please hold all questions until the question and answer session at the end of the program. There will be a continuing the conversation session in room 102 following the program. And now, on this 200th anniversary of Lincoln's birth, who was a very prescient domestic political analyst in his time, please join us in welcoming a very prescient international politics analyst, Michael Scheuer.
The only thing I share with Mr. Lincoln is a beard. I want to first thank my hosts. It's an honor to be here tonight. And it's a little embarrassing on this 200th anniversary of the second greatest American to ever live. You have to listen to the 300 millionth most important American to ever live. But I'll give it a shot. A year ago this month, I published a book entitled Marching Toward Hell, America and Islam After Iraq. As were my earlier books, Marching Toward Hell is meant to acquaint Americans with the nature of the threat they face from Osama bin Laden, al-Qaeda, and the Islamists they lead and incite. And again, as in my previous work, I argue in this book that the United States government is fighting an Islamist enemy that does not exist. Washington's Islamist enemy is the stuff of a Hollywood farce. A limited band of fanatic nihilists, ready to kill widely and indiscriminately for the pure joy of murdering, and ready to sacrifice their lives because my daughters go to university. People in Iowa hold early presidential primaries every 4 years, and because I, may God forgive me, have one or more Canadian Club and sodas after work. Would that such an enemy existed, for he would be at most a lethal nuisance and not the national security threat posed today by the Islamist movement that is symbolized and inspired by bin Laden and al-Qaeda. This farcical view of America's Islamist enemy is unfortunately endemic in the U.S. political parties, much of the U.S. Western media, and almost all of the academy. It is my assessment that this view is almost entirely without substantiation, And if it continues to be the working assumption of the U.S. government, America will be slowly but surely defeated through the loss of prestige, blood, financial solvency, and domestic political cohesion. We will lose not because the enemy is militarily stronger than we are. That certainly is not the case. Indeed, America's myopic governing elite have taken an enemy who in military capability is at most a puny 4'7", even in high-heeled sandals, and made him into a 10-foot and still growing behemoth. Why has this happened? It has happened because America's bipartisan governing elite are rank and reckless interventionists. From President Bush to President Obama, from Speaker Pelosi to Mayor Giuliani, from Vice President Cheney to Vice President Biden, from the New York Times to the Washington Times, and from Fox News to National Public Radio, America's leaders, left, center, and right, believe that there is no problem, war, revolution, ethnic conflict, crooked election, jailed female poet, or religious clash that does not require direct American involvement. And this, whether or not a single genuine U.S. national interest is at risk or can even be identified. And it is in this relentless interventionism that we find the real motivation of America's Islamist enemies, as well as the organizational glue that provides that diverse movement with an always fragile cohesion. The Islamist motivation is to be found in their perception of U.S. foreign policy as an attack on the Islamic religion and its followers, a view that is held not only by those carrying AK-47s, but, if recent polling is accurate, nearly 80% of all Muslims worldwide. Now, no American must accept the Islamists' indictment of the anti-Muslim intent of U.S. foreign policy. But to avoid eventual defeat, U.S. leaders must acknowledge and then explain to the American people that this is indeed the Muslim world's perception, and that we all must accept that perception is always reality. And what are the policies that motivate the Islamists? I can do no better than to list the six U.S. policies Osama bin Laden enumerated in the fall of 1996 and has held closely to ever since. First, the U.S. military and civilian presence on the Arabian Peninsula. Second, the United States and Western exploitation of Muslim energy resources. Third, the U.S. military's presence in Muslim lands outside the Arabian Peninsula. Fourth, U.S. support for nations that oppress Muslims, especially Russia, China, and India. Fifth, unqualified U.S. support for Israel. And sixth, U.S. support and protection for Muslim tyrannies and police states. These six policies, then, form the core of the Islamist motivation for waging war against America. And while U.S. citizens can debate whether the policy status quo should be kept or one or more of the policies should be changed or abandoned, it is likely that the maintenance of Washington's prevailing operating assumption that Muslims hate Americans for who we are and how we live, and not for what the U.S. government does in the Islamic world, will lead to nothing less than a vast and willful case of self-deception that will certainly yield calamity for the nation. In the United States today, as I'm sure you can imagine, the foregoing line of analysis is not in the mainstream. Indeed, it is more likely to be dismissed as pathological. And yet, 13 years after al-Qaeda declared war on America, the cynical act of political expediency in Iraq, known as the Surge, is unraveling. The war in Afghanistan is lost beyond recall. Pakistan is in genuine danger of going the way of Afghanistan. The Mujahideen bleed through from Iraq is visible in Jordan, Syria, Turkey, Lebanon, Palestine, and Israel. The Islamist insurgencies in Somalia and Algeria have been rekindled, with the Somalia Mujahideen nearing victory. Similar insurgencies of varying but building vitality are underway in southern Thailand, Mindanao, and the North Caucasus. The major cities of Hindu India are being attacked by Islamist fighters almost at will. And the Islamist movement in Western Europe is growing and, at least in Great Britain, has driven the traditionally stoic security services to the point of public despair. As for the United States, bin Laden has delineated al-Qaeda's war aims for defeating America in three concise phrases. First, to bleed America to bankruptcy. Second, to spread out U.S. military and intelligence forces to sap their flexibility and their reserves. And third, to undermine domestic unity in the United States as much as possible. Given these three war aims to use as a metric, I will leave it to the audience to decide whether there is any reason for Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda to be discouraged about the amount of progress they have made in the war they began in 1996. Now let me move to the second part of this talk by suggesting that the best foreign policy advice for the new Obama administration, in fact for every U.S. administration, has been heard by anyone who has flown on a civilian airliner. During the pre-flight security briefing, each passenger is told that in the case of an emergency, place your own oxygen mask on first, and only then help others with theirs. I referred to this common sense instruction in Marching Toward Hell. I believed in its pertinence to U.S. foreign policy then. I believe that it is even more pertinent today. Before America and the precious few of our allies who are able and willing to fight can defeat the expanding Islamist movement, and beat it we must, and with as much military power as needed, and certainly far more than we have used to date, the U.S. government must first put its own political and foreign policy houses in order. America can help no alliance partner or other foreign nation until it is re-anchored in its own history and traditions. And to do that, we must return to the design of the government crafted by General Washington and the other founders. Indeed, until such a reordering occurs, America cannot even help itself. In foreign policy, the key to this reanchoring is a return to an independent and non-interventionist foreign policy. If there be one principle more deeply rooted in the mind of every American, Thomas Jefferson wrote in 1791, it is that we should have nothing to do with conquest. In America's war with Islamism, we are losing because our bipartisan governing elite and its academic and media apologists have turned Mr. Jefferson on his head, much to the nation's detriment. Once elected, the leaders of both parties automatically and often mindlessly intervene in the affairs of other nations and regions. If you doubt this, recall last weekend's speech by Vice President Biden in Europe, in which he claimed the United States would make common cause with European nations who feel threatened by Russia. No nation had called for a public declaration, thus fulfilling the automatic part, and Biden's pledge just came as Washington had fatally given Moscow control over our major non-Pakistani resupply routes into Afghanistan for U.S. and NATO forces, thus meeting the equation's mindless requirement in spades. Such knee-jerk interventionism has been the hallmark of U.S. policy in the Muslim world since at least 1973. And its main objective has been to create, its main achievement has been to create a slate of policies that leaves us with few options in the region and all but guarantees endless wars with Muslims. Foreign policy is, of course, about creating options for use in protecting genuine national interests. But when Americans celebrated Independence Day last July, in the midst of a presidential election year, neither Senator Obama nor Senator McCain had the moral courage to tell Americans the truth, which is that over the last 35 years, both parties have consciously eviscerated U.S. independence on the single most important policy issue, the decision on whether or not to go to war. Both parties, for example, have failed to move the United States to energy security since the first Soviet-led embargo, Saudi-led embargo, in 1973. Instead of freeing the U.S. economy from the Arab-held dagger pointed at its heart, American presidents, Republican and Democrat, have unmanfully groveled and begged for more oil from their energy-producing masters in Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and other Arab states. The same presidents have so enormously overspent the public treasury that America is now further in the thrall of the same Arab tyrants who, with China, buy an ever-increasing portion of our debt. Because of such leadership, Americans will find they have lost the control over the decision of whether to go to war. If anti-Saudi unrest in the kingdom's eastern province ever seriously curtails oil production, U.S. soldiers and Marines will automatically deploy to defend and secure the Saudi police state and to restore oil production. And the reality of automatic war for oil goes beyond the Arab world. By 2012, the United States will import 20% of its crude from the Niger Delta. If production in that region, which is already beset by a growing insurgency, is ever significantly reduced, soldiers and Marines will automatically be deployed there to restore production. And if you think the insurgencies in Iraq and Afghanistan are nightmares, just wait until U.S. forces are fighting in 27,000 square kilometers of swamp and forest. America also has lost control of the peace or war decision because its leaders in both parties have involved them almost inextricably in the unending and unendable war between Arabs and Israelis. Ignoring and even ridiculing the founders' explicit guidance to avoid getting involved in other people's wars, both parties not only have involved us in the Middle East, but they have involved us in other people's religious wars. Can there be any better definition of an insane foreign policy than the one that today finds the United States not only involved to the hilt in other people's religious wars, but backing both of the major antagonists in that war, Israel and Saudi Arabia? By being the cash cow for and the unquestioning protector of Israel, and the only protector of the fundamentally anti-American Saudi state, Washington has created a situation in which America will be drawn into any Arab-Israeli war that includes any Arab state beyond Palestine, no matter what the wishes or the interests of the American people. Having thus all but negated the ability of the United States to abstain from wars for oil and major wars between Arabs and Israelis, the U.S. political elite has completed its axis of doom for Americans through their apparently limitless zeal for overseas democracy crusading. A perversion of what America stands for that can only lead to war and more war. The American elite's democracy crusading in Iraq has destabilized the entire Near East region, creating new threats to oil supplies and making their price almost entirely unpredictable. It also has cost American taxpayers nearly $1 trillion and killed more than 4,200 of their soldier children and wounded 32,000 more. A few more such missions accomplished in the democracy-building realm will bankrupt our nation. And the still pending threat of another war to impose democracy, this time in Iran, which is, of course, a more representative regime than any of Washington's Islamo-fascist Arab allies, would be a negative achievement of Homeric proportions. War on Iran would be billed as a war to liberate oppressed Iranians or to stop the spread of nuclear weapons, but in reality, it would be like the war in Iraq, nothing more than a war to protect Israel. Such a war, moreover, might well temporarily unite the Muslim world, 1.4 billion Muslims, if you're counting, in a jihad against the United States. If any additional proof is needed of the ingrained lust of American politicians to intervene where no U.S. interests are at risk, just recall that President Obama and Senator McCain both took time out of their campaigns last summer to praise and welcome the independence of Kosovo, thereby helping the quite mad Europeans light the fuse to the next Balkans war. And later in the summer, both men paused again after Russia invaded Georgia to urge the rapid admission of Georgia to NATO, apparently eager to give the Georgians the same sort of unredeemable and war-causing security guarantee that Great Britain gave to Poland in 1939. America's bipartisan governing elite then, with the support of the media and the academy, has brought the United States face to face with war at every turn. Wars over oil, wars over the religious conflicts in which no genuine U.S. national interest is at stake, and wars to impose secular democracy on people who will fight it to the death. This situation is surely the antithesis of what the founders intended when they designed a constitutional system meant to limit the chance of arbitrary government that inevitably leads to tyranny. The founders knew, and contemporary Americans are painfully learning, that there are a few better definitions of tyranny than one that finds an entire nation repeatedly led into wars where no national interests are at risk because of the personal beliefs, ambitions, or even whims of a single individual, be he or she a monarch, a dictator, or a popularly elected president and his closest advisors. To have a chance of defeating America's Islamist enemies, U.S. leaders must begin to give up their half-century binge of interventionism and begin to build a viable American republic to replace America's already collapsing attempt at empire. The question is, of course, how to begin to retrieve the blank check war commitments U.S. leaders have given to foreigners. In the context of the new Obama administration, let me suggest several ways of proceeding. First, America must accelerate conversion to alternative energies, expand nuclear power, and exploit U.S. fossil fuel reserves to a maximum. Nothing should be allowed to deter the ingenuity and initiative of Americans from gaining energy self-sufficiency. Demands for absolute protection for Arctic hares or shrimp-inhabited reefs at the cost of dead Marines and soldiers should be ignored. Beyond oil, America has no national interests in the Arab Peninsula, save the freedom of navigation, which one would hope the U.S. Navy can ensure. And as our energy dependence ends, this will be clear. Self-sufficiency will allow America to stop protecting the Gulf tyrannies, which now cloud our economic destiny, steadily export a religious hatred for us that is more severe than that of bin Laden, and make our advocacy of freedom appear to be a pure and even spectacular hypocrisy. It also will end the current and cruel reality that sees some portion of the price U.S. parents pay at the pump from oil-rich Arabs, flow from oil-rich Arabs to the Islamic insurgents who are killing their soldier children in Iraq and Afghanistan. Second, this country must stay out of other people's wars, particularly their religious wars. America now stands as an abject loser in the Israel-Hezbollah conflict, the Israel-Palestine war, the economic strangling of Hamas, and the recent invasion of Gaza. Indeed, America is in part losing to bin Laden and the Islamist movement because of its absolute backing of Israel and its blind eye for the Saudis' blatant and aggressive jihad spreading. America must withdraw from this savagery. No important aspect of American life or security would be negatively impacted if Palestine or Israel or both disappeared tomorrow. And we are tied to the Saudi tyranny only because of the moral cowardice of U.S. politicians. Americans also must reject their political class's patently absurd contention that U.S. and Israeli national security interests are identical. America is now shedding blood and treasure in Iraq because of our country's Israel First citizens and their journals. Men like Feith and Wolfowitz, Podoritz and Victor Davis Hanson, and their journals like the Weekly Standard, the National Review, Commentary, and the Wall Street Journal. These men and their publications provoked a hubristic war based on the idiot idea that a democratic state could be created in Muslim Iraq that would not be anti-Israeli. In doing so, they severely and permanently compromised Israel's security from the moment the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq began. Moreover, it is not a fixable situation because a potentially pro-Israel regime in Iraq exists only in the ahistorical and fervid imaginings of U.S. citizen Israeli firsters who are, when all is said and done, Israel's worst and most lethal enemies. The cost of unqualified U.S. support for Israel has heretofore been measured in the expenditures of dollars and political capital, and as such, has been acquiesced in or ignored by Americans who are inured to their government's prodigal waste of national assets. We now have transitioned into a situation where the cost of such support for Israel is or will soon be measured in the blood and lives of the children of American parents. That cost will quickly become obvious, abhorrent, and utterly unacceptable to those parents. Third, the Congress must find a backbone or be purged in 2010. And it must end its supine abdication to the executive branch of its sole power to declare war and thereby restore constitutionality and perhaps sanity to the U.S. war-making process. Infamously, no Congress has declared war since the 8th of December 1941. And yet we as a nation have been repeatedly dragged into wars because one man and his advisors have decided it is the right thing to do. Joint resolutions permitting the president to use military force offensively are cowardly acts that surrender constitutional prerogatives in a manner that allows senators and congressmen to have it both ways. They can applaud the troops if the war goes well, and they can snipe at and undermine the president if a war goes belly up. Our post-war history is littered with failed wars that were initiated by the president and which divided Americans amongst themselves. Perhaps the restoration of the founders' intent on the issue of war-making will allow Americans both to win wars abroad and not to wage them against each other at home. Fourth, finally, and most important, the United States government must stop trying to spread democracy abroad by military, financial, humanitarian, or political intervention. No young American should die for the insane goal of giving the people of Iraq a possibility of embracing democracy, a phrase that has been used ad infinitum by President Bush and other Western leaders. No small R Republican government like ours has the right to spend the lives of its young in military crusades for such patently unobtainable abstractions as giving liberty, justice, and democracy to foreigners. U.S. foreign policy must revert to what it was before the historical anomaly called the Cold War gave license to U.S. politicians to become democracy-mongering interventionists. Foreign policy is meant to defend our country, not to define who we are by doing good deeds overseas. Foreign policy need do only one thing: protect America so as to allow the domestic expansion of liberty, freedom, and the equality of conditions. If no additional foreigner ever votes in an election, Americans would be no worse off. Washington's efforts to build democracies abroad has a track record of making America less safe, not more safe. And may I ask, is there a better definition of pure waste than spending the lives of our Marines so Mrs. Mohammed can vote in an Iraqi or an Afghan election? The post-Cold War democracy crusading of U.S. administrations has impoverished us in treasure, blood, domestic political unity, in what Mr. Lincoln called the rightful influence of our Republican example. We must return to the founders' goal for America, to be the well-wisher of freedom and liberty, freedom and independence for all, but the champion and vindicator only of our own. Taken together, these four steps would begin to restore America's independence of actions and to create a non-interventionist foreign policy that would better enable Washington to adequately defend America against the Islamist forces inspired by and led by the examples of Osama bin Laden, al-Qaeda, and their allies. Non-intervention, of course, is not isolationism. The former is a policy, the latter is a mindless and knee-jerk slur. A policy of non-intervention would not rule out the U.S. military having to fight the Islamists somewhere in the world, but it probably would, most mercifully, rule out the now near certainty that it would have to fight them everywhere in the world. Washington's steady adherence to a non-interventionist agenda, moreover, would strike a direct and staggering blow on the center of gravity and on al-Qaeda and other Islamist organizations. This center of gravity is, turning Clausewitz on his head, the now hoary slate of U.S. foreign policies in the Muslim world. From this slate of policies, bin Laden and other Islamist leaders derive a glue of unity that helps keep their forces focused on the United States as a target, rather than on targets closer to home. Without U.S. interventionism as their reliable foil, the Islamist leaders' ability to keep their fighters focused on U.S. interests would be severely degraded, and their attention would begin to shift back to the targets against which their violence should be rightfully directed, the Arab tyrannies and Israel. In sum, war with the Islamists is America's war only to the extent that U.S. leaders make it one by continuing to intervene. It is far past time that the United States extricates itself from this quintessentially other people's war and let the genuine protagonists sort it out or fight it out to the death as they choose. My own view is that if we do not disengage, Inauguration Day 2013 is likely to find America in a worse mess in the Muslim world than it is today. And like today's, that mess will be largely of its own making. In closing tonight, let me take the occasion of Mr. Lincoln's 200th birthday to refer to a piece of wisdom that that great American left for his posterity to mull over, one that President Obama, I think, would do well to consider. Long before he won the presidency in 1860, Mr. Lincoln said, If destruction be America's lot, we Americans must ourselves be its author and finisher. As a nation of free men, we must live through all time or die by suicide. By God's favor, the Union Army's skill and blood, and Mr. Lincoln's steady hand, mind, and heart, America lived through its first attempt at suicide during 4 years of civil war. Today, however, we again appear ready to author our own destruction. By willfully ignoring the Islamist motivation for 15-plus years, and by treating our foreign policy as unalterable divine writ, we have left ourselves almost no options that promise victory, a situation no nation of free men should tolerate. And so we move, inexorably, toward defeat at the hands of a 4-foot-tall enemy who has been made into a 10-foot-tall behemoth due to our political leaders' sanctimony, self-deception, and moral cowardice. As long as this status quo remains, we in America neither can expect to, nor do we really deserve, to live through all time as free men. Thank you very much.
question and answer session. Please remember to wait till the mic gets to you before you speak.
Thank you for your presentation.
Sir.
Your lecture is strikingly similar to the book of Andrew Bacevich, The Limits of Power. I'm sure you're familiar with that.
I have read it, sir.
It's absolutely the same, practically the same position.
Mine was written before him.
I'm sorry. my question to you, in all this foreign policy, Bacevich talks about containment, and he makes a big point about containment. What he doesn't say clearly is how do you contain. Can you elaborate on that?
I don't think it can be contained, sir. I think Iran can be contained. I think we make an enormous bogey out of Iran. The Iranians have a third or second rate military. They've peaked in oil production, and they're surrounded by Sunnis and American military bases. Next to Iraq, no one is more containable than the Iranians. We have to defeat the Sunni Islamists where we can, but the beginning of wisdom for America is not containment, but deflection. We have to deflect this violence back to where it belongs, and that's in the Islamic world. Bin Laden and his allies have been very clear that America is not the main enemy. We're simply in the way of what they want to do. Whether or not it proves to be true, they believe that Israel, Egypt, Saudi Arabia continue to rule as they do because of American military, economic, and political support. Their goal is simply to knock us out as far as they can and then move against their real enemies.
So containment is not an option in reality.
I don't see how to contain them, sir. You know, as we have fought this war since 2001, as I tried to mention briefly tonight, jihadism has spread across Southeast Asia into the North Caucasus more fully, rekindled across North Africa, and the Europeans are, as my dad would say, done like dinner in terms of the demography of the growth of Islam in Europe. I don't think containment works on this one, sir.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Sir, just to follow up on that, lots of really good points, but when you're talking about isolationism versus anti-interventionism, my one thought was, how do we get past the fact that, well, like with multinational corporations, we don't really regulate them, but many of the, particularly the larger ones, are based in the U.S. or are seen as being American, whether they really are or not. Yeah.
There's no easy way out of this, ma'am. This is for America, this is a lose-lose situation. If we're going to go to war or fight in order to make sure our oil companies and other multinationals expand, then that's what we're going to do. But it's going to be bloody and it's going to be painful. There is a point at which you have to say enough is enough. How much more territory does Pepsi have to have? How much more acreage does Exxon have to have?
But then what's the solution? Because the United States doesn't really necessarily have that sort of legal authority internationally.
It does have the legal authority to tell American corporations that the cavalry is not coming. And it does have the same right to tell these Christian proselytizers who are going into Iraq and Afghanistan that you're perfectly free to do whatever you want, but we're not wasting any Marines to come and save your butts.
How do you do? George, your speech.
Thank you, sir.
First thing I want to ask you, from a housekeeping standpoint, your speech, can anybody get it somewhere, download it off of a website or something?
I can certainly send it to Professor Pullman, and he can load it on the website of the center if that would be sufficient.
I'm glad to know he covered one or two minor points in the world. Anyhow, real quick on three quick items. All I can say is that you outline a lot of problems, but how would you handle the Iraqi situation or the Afghanistan situation, and just add a third one to make it easy, or how would you handle the Israeli-Palestinian situation? Thank you.
I think what we have achieved in Iraq is a pause. As long as we're going to withdraw, we're probably not going to be attacked to any great extent. If we don't withdraw, the war will begin again. If we do withdraw, there'll be a civil war. My own guess, when we were talking over dinner, is we're not going to leave Iraq with any kind of sufficient force or any kind of large numbers, because if we leave Iraq, we compromise Israel's security even more than it has been by the invasion. So I would suspect pretty soon you're going to see President Obama finding reasons not to draw down the occupation force in Iraq. In Afghanistan, the war is lost. Unless we're willing to commit 250,000 or more troops, we cannot possibly do anything in that venue except extend the amount of time it takes us to be defeated. 30,000 troops in Afghanistan, in addition to what we have, is a drop in the bucket. Afghanistan is bigger than Texas. As someone said this afternoon, the topography is almost impossible to understand. And in a really odd situation, Afghanistan has expanded in size since 2001, because our battlefield in Afghanistan, because we insisted on the establishment of democracy in Pakistan, now includes the western third of Pakistan. So I personally think you should stop reinforcing defeat, but I don't think we will. What I would do, sir, and it's unfortunate to use as an example, but Gorbachev gave the Soviet military a year to do what it needed to do, or he was going to pull them out. They couldn't do it. We should give our military a year, and for the first time, really, in the last 20 years, allow the military to be the military. They had about 120 or 140, and they had unlimited barbarity. They didn't have the rules of engagement which we have, which make our soldiers targets and not killers. But I would take a year, try to kill bin Laden, Zawahiri, their lieutenants, and as much of the Taliban, and then leave. And then get out, sir, because it's going to be a running sore. On Palestine and Israel, you know, my own view is that a pox on both their houses. There's no U.S. national security interest involved there. There's no oil. There's no natural resources. There's a huge emotional commitment, but emotions, you know, are not national interests. If they can't work it out, let them go to it. We can sell them both guns. It's not a radical statement. It's just simply my view. And I made it in December and was fired from the foundation because people were going to withdraw their money. You're welcome, sir.
Hi, thank you very much for the speech. It was very enlightening. I have just one question from when you talked about turning a blind eye to the other people's religious wars. How do we as Americans do that and still be moralistically engaged in other countries around the world? And I know that we're not active in Darfur or areas like that. How do we make the distinction between a religious war and a moralistic involvement in some other country's genocide?
You never fight a war for moral interests. You fight a war for national interests and material interests. There's no reason for us to interfere in Darfur. We only can make it worse. There's nothing in Darfur that's worth the life of a Marine, at least not my son. Wars are about protecting interests that are life and death matters to us. They're not about, we talked over dinner, they're not about installing gender equality in Afghanistan or ensuring human rights in Burma. They're about making sure we have access to energy. It's about making sure that people don't have places to plan attacks against us, but it doesn't have anything to do with the kind of post-war nice-to-haves that we have established in the agenda of national interests, like gender equality, like democracy, like human rights. You don't fight wars over those kind of things. Those are the kind of things you fight for in the United States. You fight for gender equality here. You fight for the expansion of opportunity for all Americans here. We define ourselves by what we do in America, not by what we do in Darfur or in Pakistan or any other place on the earth.
We have a new administration, and we have a very old war. Do you see in the near future or within this administration opportunities for turning points? And we as citizens, what indicators should we be looking for that we have such an opportunity coming?
Truth, for once. What you should look for is an American politician that stands up and says to you, this has nothing to do with your liberty, your freedom, or your elections. It has nothing to do with your daughters going to university. What this war has to do with is what we do in the Islamic world, which is not an indictment of what we do. It's a statement of fact. And once they make that statement of fact, America can have a debate over whether or not we want the policies to remain as they are, or do we want to change. And if we keep them the same, that's the way democracy works. We go forward with them. But at least we'll know that going forward with the same policies means a lot more war, a lot more expense, and a lot more loss of life. I don't expect to see that anytime soon, sir. There's not an American politician who's going to stand up and say that. I do see hope, sir, but unfortunately, in two things. First, our fate is in our own hands. We're the only ones that can change those things that motivate our enemies. And we're the only ones that can apply sufficient force to kill as many of our enemies as we can. My own view is that what's going to change it is another disastrous attack in the United States. When we have 10 or 20 or 30,000 or more dead Americans in this country, Americans will begin to get the hint that their government has not been pursuing a policy that is in their best interests. Sir.
Thank you for coming. I'm really lost. I hope you can answer this and maybe some of the other people who clapped tonight. I'm pretty disappointed. I just want to know if you could explain what makes an American life so much more important than a life of anyone else in the world.
They're Americans. We don't elect people. We don't pay taxes to protect the lives of other people who threaten us. Again, it's another thing we were talking. I've been out of school for 40 years, so it's a very different world. But to think that some American Secretary of Defense or President is going to apologize because in the effort to destroy our enemies, we kill a few Afghans or Iraqis should automatically disqualify that person from office. It's an insane idea. How do you conduct a war in that manner? If you want to lose, I guess that's the way you do. Go ahead, sir.
Well, I'm not referring to any specific incident. You say yourself that morals don't matter in foreign policy and that we should only get involved to protect American interests.
Yes, exactly. And we kill the number of people that need to be killed until those interests are protected or at least not threatened. I don't understand what doesn't follow in that train of logic.
I'm not trying to say that we shouldn't protect American interests. I just believe that there are times where morality calls for us to intervene when American interests aren't present.
Well, we just disagree on that, sir. I don't think there's any occasion for that. Maybe when you have a son, you may feel differently, sir.
You mentioned that we can only make things worse if we get involved in situations, and you used Darfur as an example. What would you say of examples then, say in 1978 with Jimmy Carter sitting down with Sadat and the Israeli Prime Minister for the Camp David peace accords, and it was often been said that the peaceful relations that came out of that wouldn't have been possible had Carter not gotten involved.
We're still at war, aren't we?
True,
yeah. It was a try for which some people approve of it. I don't think it's any of our business. I think we have done Israel a huge disservice by not letting them defeat the Palestinians. It's just simply none of our business. There's no reason that the problem still exists. Israel has an enormous capability to destroy the Palestinians. But every time they start, we intervene and say, no, you can't do that. Well, I believe that every state in the world has the right to defend itself to the maximum, including the United States of America. In terms of Israel, I simply don't think that we should be tired by what they do. That's all.
Thank you very much. I agree with most, if not all, of what you've been saying.
Don't tell your friends, sir.
Yes, that could be dangerous. My question is, do you see any parallels between this U.S. destructive U.S. foreign policy and foreign policy of China or Russia and their subsequent animosity with the Muslim world?
You know, I think one thing I would say is the process of intervention is one that is not well received in the Islamic world. And the Soviet Union, for example, was an anti-Muslim, atheist country for, help me here, 70, 80 years before they invaded Afghanistan. No Muslim army or insurgent group ever tried to take down the Soviets in their own territory. The war against the Soviets started when they invaded a Muslim country. The Chinese were, you know, the problem the Chinese have is they're trying to launch a genocide against the Uyghur Muslims. What we oppose in Tibet, which is the introduction of the Han Chinese in huge numbers to make sure the Tibetans don't have a majority, is exactly what they're doing in Western China. But we say it's wrong in Tibet, but in Western China we say it's fighting terrorism. So who knows what to think? That's their problems. It appears that the Russians are going to be facing a demographic disaster, as are the Europeans in the years ahead.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Thank you so much. And thank you for coming, sir.
Yes, pleasure, sir.
You were saying earlier about truth, and I feel that that's one of the most important things. How would you implement more truth, especially with the media, basically, in the print media especially, being shut down in such large numbers across the country?
It's interesting, isn't it? You know, my son this year is taking U.S. government. He's a senior, and we were reading together again de Tocqueville. And in Democracy in America, de Tocqueville says the only way to ensure freedom of the press and the distribution of the truth is to make sure there are enormous numbers of newspapers. The danger to truth is in the contraction of newspapers, and that's kind of what we're facing at the moment. I don't know how to do it. I frankly will tell you. It is impossible in this media to talk about, how hard is it for any politician to get elected or get praised if he wants to drill in the Arctic? Or if he wants to drill off the coast of Florida. The media doesn't like it.
I was just wondering about one other thing then. If truth is the most important thing, how is it that history books are being allowed to be printed with basic blatant lies in areas? School districts have decided that it's okay to print this thing because it formulates their view of the politics and their view of an occurrence. That the invasion of Kuwait, say, for example. The H.W. Bush administration at the very beginning said, yes, we will not interfere with local regional occurrences. And suddenly the Kuwaiti people in the United States spent millions of dollars promoting a program of saying, hey, we got to stop the Iraqis, when the Iraqis were actually having a conflict with the Kuwaitis over oil because the Kuwaitis were drilling 150 miles away from their border inside Iraq. By a pipeline, incredible, 150 miles, unbelievable. Can you imagine having somebody in Nova Scotia drilling into Maine for gold?
Yeah.
So how do you stop something like that? How do you stop lies from being published and our children being influenced by absolute lies?
over dinner. When my son was in first grade in Fairfax County in Virginia, they had a wonderful book about Galileo that the kids were reading, but they stopped halfway through. And at the next PTA meeting, I went and said, you know, this was a great book. It told a lot about what Galileo did. And I said, why did you stop? And they said the county won't allow it all to be read. They have to stop where Galileo has the falling out with the church because they don't want to offend any Catholics or... I don't know. How do you avoid that kind of insanity? How do you avoid the insanity of saying that Mr. Washington and Mr. Lincoln are dead, irrelevant white men? But that's pretty much the kind of thing that's taught in our schools today. I don't know how to change that. Certainly what Mr. Obama was brought up on.
Hi. You mentioned Europe. If you could put yourself in their shoes for a second, where there's an increasing amount of conservative Muslim Arab immigrants on the continent, creating a lot of trouble for the rest of the population there who...
In Europe, you mean?
Yeah, in Europe.
Yeah.
Who values tolerance, enlightened values, that Arab population does not. And given the fact that they're stubbornly kind of refusing to assimilate to those values, how would a European country change that situation without trying to affect the policies, the culture of the places they're coming from?
The Germans decided that they thought if the EU declared a one national Islamic holiday that would probably satisfy the Muslims. I'm being facetious. The Europeans have really created for themselves a problem. They have appeased demands. They have denigrated their sources of unity, whether it is nationalism or the church. And I think it will be interesting to see over the next 20 years if the Europeans go quietly into that Islamic good night and everyone gets fitted for a burqa, or do they return to what they're best at, which is fascism and war making? Do they become nationalists? Do they go back to Christianity? I don't know what the answer is. But the Muslims know where they're going. They know what they want, and they know what they believe, which is much better than being a citizen of the European community and trying to rally around the common agricultural policy. And having a demographic that is less, you know, a full percentage point less than the replacement rate. Europe's replacing at 1.4. Muslim families are producing at 5 point something. The rubber's going to hit the road here somewhere, and it's going to be interesting to see. It's very poignant in a way, because Europe is a place where we have we come from Europe. Our traditions come from Europe, and probably Europe is the place we can help least. Oh, it's undoubtedly a national security risk. Oh, for them it is. I don't know if it is for us. What are we going to do? Well, if people won't defend themselves, there's not much we can do about it, is there? But look, you know, we don't even... we're in such a state that somehow we've defined out of the concept of national security and national defense protecting our borders. We're not a lot better than the Europeans. So I don't know what the answer is going to be, but the Europeans are in tough shape, and the status quo won't last. They're going to have to decide to do something. Like the Archbishop of Canterbury wants to adopt some portions of Sharia law. Good Lord.
I'm having sort of a schizophrenic reaction, and I figured out that it's because you're really talking more about national defense strategy than about foreign policy. And let me explain. The reason all those Muslims are in the UK is not a little due to the lack of democracy in the Islamic world. Now, in your formula, we can't worry about that. But now that we're the sole superpower in the world, we can't see all conflicts, or that the only conflicts we want to be involved in are those that only involve us. That's how I understood you. And I think this business of making allies, whatever you want to call it, Kissingerian or whatever, is because there may be wars in which we need coalitions. And, I mean, I agree with all your views on the war on terror, except it wasn't just to spread democracy. The idea was to destroy the capacity of the jihadists not only to attack us, but to attack our interests. And we haven't succeeded.
We haven't tried.
Well, but that may be because we fought the war on our own, because we never defined it in a way.
I would argue that it's because we didn't fight the war on our own. We took along people who wanted to dig wells and inoculate children and teach schools, but people who didn't want to fight. What going to Afghanistan with an alliance did was to limit the amount of savagery we could apply. Read Bob Woodward's book about Bush at war, with Colin Powell advising the president not to hit targets because it might offend the Arabs or the Europeans. More important to keep the coalition together than to protect America by winning.
But we did not fight a global war on terror, whatever we're going to call it now. It was a U.S.-designed war on terror. And it hasn't worked in the sense that you're saying. The multiplication of effort in the one element of withdrawal, I agree with you, but then I heard you say we have to stay in Iraq.
Stay where?
In Iraq.
We will stay in Iraq, not because we have to, but because we have to protect the Israelis. By taking out Saddam, we created a westward highway from South Asia for the jihadis to get to an area where they would never have been before. And now if we leave, Israel is that worse off. And now that we have an IDF veteran who is the chief of staff to the President of the United States, how likely is it we're going to leave Iraq?
You talked about how we should try to get off our oil dependency to increase our security. Do you think that some powers that are very reliant on the oil money, like Saudi Arabia, could use our financial insecurity to hurt us by not loaning us money, by trying to call in debt if we try to become more oil independent? Do you think we are going to face resistance if we do this?
I wouldn't be surprised. But we've created this monster ourselves by borrowing money from the Arabs, by borrowing money from the Chinese. It's a problem we have, and it's a problem we have to face. Will they use it? I suppose they'll use it if they can do it without hurting their economies too badly. But if they decide to go ahead, there's not much we can do about it. It is a situation where we put our head in the lion's mouth.
I wanted to get your opinion on our policies that drive from participation in international institutions like the United Nations and sort of our position in peacekeeping and sending in soldiers.
I think we should be fully involved in distributing around the world a surplus American agricultural goods, medical education, laptop computers. I think we should have nothing to do with the United States, with the United Nations in a military sense, in peacekeeping terms.
Thank you for your talk. I too am somewhat conflicted. What do you say to the percentage of Americans that have a conscience about cleaning up the messes that we've made all over the world? You know, you've talked about Iraq and Israel and Afghanistan as a mess, and I agree. But if we walk away, you know, I think there's a fundamental American feeling of we made a mess, we should clean it up. If we walk away and it becomes a failed state, do we just sit back and watch?
It's all we can do.
Disaster.
We certainly cannot stop it from being a failed state unless we continue to bleed in money and human beings. There's people here from the War College. I don't think anybody is ever taught to reinforce defeat. We shouldn't go there in the first place. If we went there in the first place, we should have won. If we're not going to win, we ought to come home.
Do you see any potential for meaningful dialogue with Islamic leaders? If we took a better stance with the Islamic world, do you see any potential of that turning things around?
It's hard for me to see a discussion of... First of all, we wouldn't know how to do it. We're very trained to think in terms of nation states. We judge all of these people to be criminals, so we're not going to sit down with them. And I'm not sure, at least right now, when they think they're winning, they'd want to talk anyway. I think what we want to get to is a position where they're killing anybody but an American. That should be the goal of our policy.
Talk. In your opinion, why was there such a gross failure of the intelligence community in the lead up to the Iraq war?
You know, it's a hard thing to tell. I came into the agency in 1982 when we were running four wars under Mr. Reagan. We were kind of diddling around in Cambodia. We were supporting the Contras. We were working with Jonas Savimbi in Angola, and we were fighting the Mujahideen. The one thing that officers who came in that era learned was never to trust the reporting of the people who you were supporting, because you were doing for them what they couldn't do for themselves. And my generation is the generation that is kind of at the mid-level, junior, senior-level people, and they know that. All of our information on Iraq, on weapons of mass destruction, said the same thing, that Saddam had it, that he was the potential power of Iraq and WMD was growing. That was common across all the Western services. But it was also all information from people who were opposed to Saddam and who were far less effective militarily than the Afghan Mujahideen or Jonas Savimbi. So they really were dependent on us to do something that they couldn't do for themselves. Over time, it appears that Mr. Tenet, when he was the director, appointed himself a briefer-in-chief, if you will, to the president. Traditionally, the agency sends a very senior staff officer who has a very thick skin, doesn't want to be the president's friend. His job is to go to the president and give him two stories. First, Mr. President, this is what the information shows. Second, Mr. President, this is the quality of the reporting, the reliability of it. Is it human reporting? Is it SIGINT? Is it overhead imagery? It appears that Mr. Tenet did half the job, that when he took the information to the president, he provided the story, Saddam has WMD, but he didn't say it came from charlatans like Shalabi or the rest of them. Now, I don't know if it would have made a difference. I think the president and Cheney and Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld wanted that war. But I think the failure, it is unfair at this point to say it was an intelligence community failure, because the focal point to the president was one individual who wanted to be part of the team. That's just my guess.
Hello. Just a question. Can you honestly say that you can envision a world where U.S. is not involved anywhere militarily?
No. I can envision a world where we're not involved militarily, where we don't need to be.
So, for example, when it comes to Middle East, are you saying that U.S. shouldn't be involved in the Middle East at all?
No. I'm saying that if it's in our interest to be involved, as it was in Afghanistan, we should have been. And we should have left the message in Afghanistan whatever it took in terms of body count in smoldering cities, don't screw with the Americans. No need for us to be in Iraq. We have no interest in the Israeli-Palestinian business. You know, of course you use your military when it's in your interests, but you don't use your military because it helps somebody else.
But can you imagine what would happen if, for example, tomorrow U.S. said we're not supporting Israel anymore?
What difference does it make to the United States?
But wouldn't don't you think a really big war would break out in the whole Middle East region, which would affect U.S.?
It might not, but that's the way it goes. You know, wars are best left to burn themselves out. This idiot Holbrooke now who's going to go to South Asia. What he did in the Balkans was simply give everyone a time out. They're all arming to the teeth. And when we leave, that war starts again. The time to aid people is after somebody has been, after the war burns itself out.
I agree with that. In a sense, I just can't help but think of World War II, for example, whereas, I mean, after World War I, U.S. pulled out, and a lot of people say that one of the reasons that, for example, the League of Nations didn't work is just because U.S. didn't support it. So I can't help but wonder what would happen if U.S. I mean, I agree it is a big price to pay, loss of deaths, loss of lives, financial losses, but I can't help but wonder what would happen if U.S. truly, truly removed itself and said we're backing down, just another big war.
I guess it would be interesting to see how it would work out.
With the nuclear weapons, I'm not sure if we would survive.
Well, we certainly have more nuclear weapons than the next kid on the block.
Hello.
Fine.
I don't know if you're familiar with the book The Human Factor by Ishmael Jones, but he, like you, is a CIA officer. And he says that one of the biggest things, one of the biggest failures of the intelligence community is lack of human intelligence. I don't know if you agree with that or not, but how do you think that we could fix that problem?
I don't know if it is fixable. My own view is, against the Islamists, if we wait for human intelligence to do the trick, we're going to be out of luck. If you got a minute, I'll explain. When I think in some ways the Islamist target is a much harder target than the Soviet target was. The Soviet Union was such a corrupt and sordid place that if we recruited a Soviet, and I'm talking with an expert in the audience, the system was so corrupt it became apparent that it wasn't the workers' paradise. And if we had recruited a non-Russian, Russian racism helped. The system worked for us. The further they got into the system, the more corrupt and sordid it was. All we had to do to appear attractive is to be ourselves. We did have enough food for our people. We did have a car in every garage. We did have a house for everyone. With the Islamists, what we found is it's very easy to recruit an Islamist at the outer level of their organizations. The people that run guns, the people that run narcotics, the document forgers, the safe house keepers. But when you recruit them and send them into the organization, the further they get in, at least in some of the Islamist organizations, they see that the leader isn't 1,000 miles away in Tampa running the war. He's living with his fighters. Ayman Zawahiri is a renowned surgeon of one of the top families in Cairo, but he's lived in Afghanistan and fought for the last 20 years. Osama bin Laden is the heir to part of a fortune that's worth about $20 billion, but he's drinking Afghan water for 25 years. The system works against us. As an Islamist asset works into these systems, more often than not, he becomes beguiled by them. There's a book I would recommend to you by a man named Omar Nasiri. It's called Inside the Jihad, and it describes this process. It's a very hard human target. My own view is that we really need better SIGINT. We need especially close-in signals intelligence. You know, the world has changed, and so the National Security Agency does satellite intercepts, and they tap underground fiber cables. Well, the enemy's using World War II and Korean War COMO equipment on the field, push-to-talk radios, high-frequency radios. We don't do that anymore. And so until we kind of go back to a previous generation of SIGINT collection, we have a hard time. Yes?
I appreciate Ms. Suhor's description of having sort of a schizophrenic response or reaction, because there seems as though there's no distinction between foreign policy in wartime and foreign policy in general. And also what I'm having difficulty swallowing is the notion that we should take a step back more towards an isolationist approach. And you quoted George Washington and Thomas Jefferson's no entangling alliances. which it seems difficult to swallow that when we can't ignore the fact that we are an ever globalizing, interconnected world, much more so than at the time that our founding fathers were talking. And I'd just like to hear what you have to say about that, considering.
Well, the founding fathers, of course, were never isolationist. America has never been isolationist. You know, they always say, someone said that we were isolationist and withdrew from the world after World War I. The truth is that our business, scientific, and educational endeavors during the interwar period were greater than they were ever previously. No one is saying we can be isolationist. It's impossible. America, since the first day, has been a trading nation, whether it's on the high seas or now in the air. But you can pick your spots. You can be. Ralph Peters is a strategist who wrote, "You have to learn to watch others die with equanimity," and that's about what I think. There are places we need to be involved to protect our own interests, whether those are economic, energy, or military. But there are places that really doesn't matter what happens. Darfur is the perfect example of that. If it bothers your conscience, then, you know, everybody's free to go be an NGO or join a convent or whatever you want to do. But I don't think it's a commitment to cost the American lives to sort out a civil war in the Sudan.
Hey, I just wanted to say that you mentioned briefly a few times about rules of engagement, that kind of thing, and I have to say I completely agree with you. I find them ridiculous, and I think that people kind of have to understand that, you know, war is going to be as unpleasant and unfortunate as it is, that it's going to be brutal, and you can't really criticize that, I think, unless you've been there. But do you think that there's any way that the U.S., with its kind of image in the world, that it can circumvent these types of rules so it can be effective in combat?
We're the boys that brought you the firebombing of Tokyo and Dresden. Of course, the only mercy in war is victory at a fast pace. There's no other, you know, stringing out a war so it lasts 8 years or 10 years is a mercy to no one, especially to ourselves. I think war should always be the last resort, but you should never go to war unless you're going to win. This damn Petraeus doesn't even use the word victory.
Thank you, sir, for your contributions to us all. My question is really a request for you to discuss, if you please, your expectations of the role, capabilities, and effectiveness which you foresee our new national security advisor being able to do in addressing these challenges you presented.
I have always had enormous respect for Marines. My father was one, and I learned to respect the hard way many times. I personally dislike the expansion of the power of the NSC. It's a concentration of power in an unelected body. I think General Jones is trustworthy, but I think the executive has more power than it needs already. I hope it works out, but it just seems to me that it's a grab for more power. You know, for all of the charges that were made against the Bush administration about concentrating power in the executive branch, they never tried to do what General Jones's NSC is trying to do in terms of holding power to themselves. So in terms of the Islamic world, nothing's going to change unless we realize why the war is going on, sir. If General Jones stands up and says, "Yeah, our politicians have been lying to you guys in America for the past 30 years. This doesn't have to do with liberty. It has to do with what we do." Then we got a chance. Unless they do that, it's just more of the same.
This will be our last question of the night.
To listen to your discourse, you would think that with regard to Western Europe, there were a bunch of rabid Islamists waiting in the wings to take the place over. It is true that in some countries there is a Muslim population that verges on 10%. The birth rate, by the way, is not as high in some countries as you have said. And one interesting thing, just in passing, is that the longer a Muslim woman resides in a European country, the fewer children she has, and it's not just a question of her getting older. It's because she's more integrated. I would say this, that I agree with you with regard to the demographic time bomb. If you take the figures out to 2050, you will see that the Western European populations are quite old, the younger Muslim populations are growing. But I think, by and large, their quest has been one of integration and not overthrow. And I think, in many cases, the Europeans have brought it on their own heads because they have not allowed these populations to integrate sufficiently. In a country like France, we're now at the second, third, and fourth generation of young Muslims who are French citizens and who live in those suburbs. And I think it was fairly well documented that the riots that were seen in October and November of 2005 were not Islamist-inspired. Yeah. They were rather a cry for better economic conditions and better living conditions. Now, I know that there's a re-Islamization movement among some younger, heretofore secular young people from the Middle East who have taken up Islamic practice again, but it's not necessarily motivated by hardcore Islam. It's a search for identity.
I don't disagree with all of that, sir. I think I agree with most of it. And I don't think that the Islamic population in Europe is at all rabid. They have been very outspoken in saying, we don't need to really do anything because we're going to win through the cradle. We can win over time in the parliamentary system. The problem with waiting to assimilate is that the Europeans, because of their demography, continue to need immigrants from somewhere. They intend to win electorally.
Wait, is there anything wrong with that?
Oh, absolutely. Unless you want to be a Sharia law person, if you want a majority or some kind of a Sharia law in an English common law country, I think there's plenty wrong with it. Pardon?
There's secularism
is not a defense against. It's more of assurance of appeasement than it is a defense. Well, that you would think so, but it's the fourth generation, the third and fourth generation, who are the most militant in Europe, people who have never been back to their home countries and who can't speak Arabic. It's the younger people that are the problem, and they're reproducing at a rate that there's more and more younger people. You know, Europe, post-war Europe, is just a shell of what it used to be. The European community is basically an institution that exists because the Europeans said we're not adult enough not to have wars, so we have to mold all of these identities together under some socialist organization in Brussels. If you're depending on the Europeans to help us or defend themselves, I think it's a mistake. I think the Europeans, except for the British, are the most feckless lot that we could have tied ourselves to. Thank you all.